They must not have been told that I was coming.
Oh, speaking tonight.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jessica. I'm an alcoholic and an addict. It's been a while since I've spoken, so I'm a little bit rusty, I guess. So I guess I'll start with talking about someone else. Maybe my parents. My father's an alcoholic. Actually, my father, I'm now his legal guardian. He never got sober. He had, he made many attempts to get sober and, or, yeah, he made probably some honest attempts to get sober and he never managed to get sober. He ended up in Alberta living on the street. And he chose a good province, though. It was a rich province, and they took him in. And he got a actually a rather nice room to live in and some really wonderful people that helped him out and took care of him that I'm very grateful for. And now he's in a home because he has alcohol-related dementia, and part of his brain has folded. They don't call it wet brain, but it is wet brain. It's a version thereof. And he keeps thinking that he's going up to our cottage, you know. So I talked to him, and he says, "I'm going to the cottage." And I said, "Well, that's great, Dad. You know, have a good time. I'll see you there." And I'm over any resentment I had towards my father. My father was a raving alcoholic throughout my, as far back as I can remember. And my mother spent all her energies and efforts taking care of my father. And as a result, all of the children, there are four of us in the family, were just kind of problematic. You know, nobody really quite knew what to do with us. As long as we were in school and not causing any trouble, it was, you know, everything was considered to be okay. I was a very loud, demanding kid, always the squeaky wheel in the family. And as I grew up, I had an older sister who just kind of gave up. I had a younger brother who I thought I had to protect, and I had a younger sister who didn't end up being raised by us because of my father's alcoholism and the family situation. So I thought it was my job to protect everyone. I have memories. I remember beating up people who had stolen my sister's bicycle. My sister was older than me. I remember somebody who had bothered my brother. This was later on when we had moved into the city. I remember beating his friend up and his older sister, just for good measure. So I became really loud and really wild, and I was very aware that we were singled out because of my father's alcoholism, even in a neighborhood that everyone was dysfunctional. Actually, they were in much worse shape than we were, but I didn't know it at the time. There's a lot of child molesting going on, a friend of mine who was molested as a kid that I didn't realize until later. A lot of kids were beaten up, but we didn't know all this. It was, it was a dysfunctional neighborhood, forget about family. And growing up there, we fit right in, and I was kicked out of elementary school. I was really angry. I remember being furious from a very young age, so I decided that I was going to be good at everything that I did. I was going to be better than everyone at everything. So I was really good at school. I was really athletic, and but I was incredibly angry. And being raised in an alcoholic family, nobody listens to you. You're just a problem, you know. So I would come back with report cards or come back with, nobody's ever at parent-teacher's night. There's nobody ever there on your side. So it really doesn't matter what you do for attention. So I decided that if I wasn't getting any attention by getting good marks, then I was going to set fires or something. This is the way my brain works. So I decided to start setting fires in little fires here and there. I would break into the school. I would vandalize stuff. This is growing up. And finally got some attention. So I was happy. I got some attention. I got thrown out of elementary school, and that was fine with me because I was really, really angry. So by 12 years old, I was smoking marijuana in the bathrooms in elementary school and doing LSD and going to class by the time I was 13 in grade 8. So I started off doing drugs almost immediately from the time I was an adolescent and left school at 15. And I mean, I was definitely an instant addict alcoholic from the time I was 12 years old. I think I immediately knew what alcohol was for. It was to get drunk. I never understood anyone who thought that alcohol was, I mean, who could have a drink. It was just something that made absolutely no sense to me. It still makes no sense to me to have a drink. I get a headache if I have one drink. Gives me like a splitting headache. And two drinks is even worse. Two drinks is just impossible. And I'm a really bad drunk. I mean, when I drink, I'm very angry. I'm really discontent. I'm totally negative, and I feel like breaking things. I get extremely angry, and I don't like to be angry today. Today I'm not angry, but I, you know, went through that all through childhood. Actually, not through childhood, all through adolescence. Childhood, I was actually quite a happy kid. So I immediately, by the time I left school, I left home shortly thereafter, and there I was 15 years old, and had no clue what I wanted to do, except that I wasn't staying at home, so I left home. I left home at 15, and started working in bars shortly thereafter, pretended I was older, was easy to get fake IDs, so I was working in bars, I was working... I was making plastic bottles in a bottle factory at various times, and it took me about 15 more years until I got back to school. I had made like other forays back into school, but I always wanted to go back to school, and I could never. I always wanted to study. I always wanted to. I've read throughout my entire alcoholism. I always saw a better life for myself, but I could never get to it. I always felt as if I was this little kid with my nose pressed up against a window looking into this scene where everybody was warm and had this great food and there was all this furniture and plants and velvet curtains, and I'd be staring into this window, and I was never invited in. And that's the way that I felt most of my life, that there was always a party or something going on somewhere else that I was not invited into. So I started working, and I was, you know, just kind of eking by. When I think back on it, I think I was very lucky that you know, really terrible things didn't happen to me. Not many of them, anyways. There were a few of them, but I used to hitchhike. I hitchhiked across Canada. There were a few, you know, really bad scenes where I'd have to jump out of cars to escape. But I was really lucky. I thought I was actually almost invincible. I was never worried. I was very fast. I would, you know, but this whole way through, I was doing just tons and tons I was just doing whatever drug came along. And eventually I discovered needles and I discovered heroin and cocaine, which was my favorite mix. And throughout the entire time, I never really thought I was an addict because I would stop doing drugs and pick up alcohol. When it got just too heavy to do drugs, they were just either too expensive or there were too many people after me, I would just stop. And then I would start to drink. And I would drink for periods of time, and there was nothing else. And then when that got absolutely sickening, and my stomach was a mess, and then I would start to do drugs again. I would rediscover drugs, and I'd go from one to another, back and forth. Somewhere along the line in this period of time, I ended up at Fort McMurray. This is quite a while ago, and I was a flag girl at Fort McMurray. And I would get all these... have to stop, go, that was my big job, and I was paid a fortune for that. over 20 years ago, 25 years ago. And these guys would come in and they'd bring me all kinds of drugs because there's no women there. It was like 27 to 1. So it was great. So I had all these guys and there's trucks bringing me in all kinds of dope, and it was just, everything was wonderful. So, and I was living in this trailer that a friend had allowed me to stay in with a bunch of other people. And when they found out that there was a girl living there, this guy got evicted from the trailer. And he was just a friend. We were just buddies. And I always felt really, I felt really bad about it because I'd been living there for nothing and making all this money and I had all these drugs and it was, you know, really kind of highlight of my drinking career. I was 19. And so I gave him, he got evicted and he got blacklisted in the town, so I had all this money saved up, because I still used to save money for some unknown reason. And I gave him $1,000. I said, you know, thanks for letting me stay here, some rent. And he took the $1,000, apparently went to Toronto and started a gravel company and became a big success, came back 3 years later and looked for me in Montreal, found me and said, and he said, I've been looking for you everywhere, and I don't know how he found me. Maybe I was in the phone book, one of those odd years where I was. And I'm in my early 20s at this point, and he said, and he took a look at my, you know, I was living in this little place, and he said, is there anything I can do for you? I want to thank you for the $1,000. And I said, get me a ticket to India. And I was drunk. And so he did, and he got me a ticket to India. And so I went to India, and I went there, and I was actually hated it, but I had too much pride to leave because I thought I was this great world traveler, and I was telling everybody I was going to India, and I was very cool, and everything was fine, and I got there, and I was absolutely terrified. I mean, there were bodies in the railway station, and it was sheer pride that a lot of my life was motivated by pride. It was sheer pride that forced me to stay there for long enough to actually start a business. So I started a business there, became severely addicted to opium and heroin later on when I came back here. But the business was a success, and it was a jewelry business, started designing jewelry and bringing it back. And that worked really nicely, but I was always absolutely hollowed out inside. I was empty. And I remember I was engaged to be married to my partner at the time, and I would look at him feeling as if he was from this great distance, that I could not really love this person, and I knew that I was actually incapable of love. And I mean, I did love him. I really thought I knew he was a wonderful person, but I could not feel, and especially not accept, love from another human being. It was an impossibility to accept that somebody loved me. I understood it. I profited from it, but I could not accept it, and I could not return it. So I think it was that, because I had so much respect for this person. It was something that, and he was the first person that ever called me an alcoholic. He said, well, I forget what happened. He said, well, that's because of your alcoholism. And I thought, alcoholism? And something in that stayed with me. I knew that it was true, that I was an alcoholic. And that was fine, you know. I mean, it was the generation that sort of, you know, stated that reality is for people who can't handle drugs, and I really believed that. I mean, I really believed, in a sense, that I was just more evolved, you know. I was just, I never had any sort of romantic illusions about wanting to be married with children. It was just not something that I romanticized. It was not something I wanted. I had other illusions, but those were not, that was not a path that I saw for myself. I don't know exactly what I saw for myself, but it never really involved anything that I thought was, you know, any sort of a comfortable or middle class existence. Just didn't have any appeal for me at all. So I just continued to drift. But when I hit bottom, because there were quite a few bottoms in there. There were, after I got rid of, after that relationship ended, was when I started spiraling downhill. And I had met a few more people. I had gotten involved in a relationship with an extremely angry person, and I felt very relieved to be with this individual because then I could really drink. So I knew that once I met him, he drank more than I did, and that was unusual. That was hard to find. I had given up India by then. I had sold business, and he drank a lot, and I drank a lot. And we would get into these roaring battles, and he hit me. And I remember looking in the mirror the next morning, and I had a black eye. And I believed finally that what I felt on the inside was finally showing in the mirror. And I looked at myself in the mirror, and I thought, this is who you are. This is who you've become. I would go into blackouts constantly at the bottom of my last 2 years of drinking. I remember coming to, and I was jumping up and down on a car hood on Stanley. I remember coming to, and I was smashing crystal glasses, throwing them across the room. Another boyfriend who had gotten an inheritance, and part of it, he'd got his grandmother's glasses, and I was breaking them one at a time, throwing them across the room, and I came to when I was doing it. So I would constantly, I would come to in these scary places. I'd be driving, I'd be in a car, and I didn't know who I was with, and we would be driving across the mountain. And I'd think, where am I, you know? And it was amazing that I was not hurt. Nothing really bad happened to me. There were a lot of guardian angels around, a lot of people that, I mean, I remember this cab driver, and I was like raging at him, and he was just really an Iranian guy, really nice guy. He just drove me. He just drove me to a friend's house, and I remember him saying, well, where do you want to go? Where do you want to go? When I came to, and I realized he'd been driving me around for an hour, trying to help me find somewhere that I wanted to go. I was devastated. I was drunk all the time. I couldn't, at this point I was ready to be evicted from my apartment. I was not holding down a job. I could not stop drinking. I remember pouring alcohol down the sink and then thinking, what am I doing, and grabbing it, and then waking up a day later and just going into constant blackouts. So that was at my bottom. And then, that's right, I remember phoning in a blackout, calling. I'd hooked up with, I'd stayed sober for about 2 weeks or so. And in the meantime, through an AA member, I don't even remember exactly how I met this person. But through him, I met a friend named Joe, who I don't think has ever gotten sober either. And he and I became really great friends. And we used to drink beer together and smoke mostly a lot of cigarette butts and watch Coronation Street. That was like our big deal. And those were really good memories of mine, where we'd get together and watch Coronation Street. And he had tried to get sober, and he told me AA doesn't work. He said, don't bother going to AA. It just doesn't work. And I started to go anyways, and we became friends. But I mean, I went once or twice, and I felt like a ghost at the back of the meeting, just watching what was going on and knowing that this could never work for me and feeling very sad about it. And finally, one evening, I phoned Foster, and he had gone to Foster. And 2 weeks later, just as I was about to get evicted from an apartment, they called, and I said, okay, I'll go, I'm in. So I got really drunk the night before and very high the night before and got somebody to drive me, and there I was in Foster. And next thing I know, I was sober. So that's how I got sober, but it didn't really last. I mean, it lasted for 2 weeks, and then something happened to me, which was a spiritual awakening, I guess. It was my spiritual awakening, and it was very quiet, but it was very profound for me. I had realized that I didn't really believe that I was going to get sober. And I walked around, and I was going to the meetings, and I thought that, it dawned on me that I had to get honest, and I really didn't believe that I was going to actually get sober. And so I thought, well, why am I here if I don't believe that I'm going to get sober? And I was not in and I was not out. I was satelliting around the program. I was like a zombie. And I came back, and the night before I had gone out and had a slip. Somebody came to my door who had heroin, and I said yes, and I did some heroin. I woke up the next morning, and I understood that I had been given a chance to get sober. I felt that I was handed this opportunity, and I didn't believe it, but I knew that it wasn't going to come around again for a long time, because I really do think things happen in cycles. And every few years something is handed, like a job opportunity. Something is handed to you, something that is profound. And if you don't grab it, it does come again, but it doesn't come for a long time. I had had a series of dreams and a series of events just before I got sober. One of them was that I had an overdose, and a friend of mine, who I hadn't seen for about 3 or 4 years, happened to find me, race up to the apartment, and find me literally overdosed on the floor with a syringe on the floor. And that was a total coincidence. And I remember that. I mean, there's no reason for him to have been there at the time. I went into the hospital. They gave me some Narcan. I came out of it. I went back. I scored again. I ended up ODing again in the same hospital. That was my bottom. And that happened to me for about 2 years. And there was a lot of overdoses. There were a lot of near misses. There were a lot of very dangerous occurrences where, mostly to do with drugs, rip-offs. There was some very bad scenes. There was jail all around me. People were going off to jail. And I thought that, and I knew that I would, you know, my number, and I was terrified of being incarcerated. Because even in all my trips to India, I imported jewelry. I never imported drugs. I never, ever risked my freedom. It was my only rule. It was a line that I couldn't cross, that I was not going to ever risk my freedom. I was never going to be in jail. And I looked around me, and I could see that line was coming closer and closer to me. And it scared the hell out of me. And I don't scare easily. I really didn't scare easily then. Now I'm a wimp, but then I wasn't. So I had a dream that night when I was leaving town, when I was about 6 or 8 years old, I had these nuns. I was raised by nuns, actually, in the school. I was taught by a lot of nuns. And when I left the school, this nun that I really loved gave me a sticker of a guardian angel. And it was a gorgeous Renaissance androgynous guardian angel with this huge wingspan, this cherubic face. And I remember that sticker, and I loved that little sticker, and I believe that I always had this guardian angel. As trite as that is, I mean, I know guardian angels are in style, but I had them before they came into style, I think. And I had this dream that night that the guardian angel was leaving. And I knew that that meant that I was going to die. So the night that I was rescued and I ended up in the hospital twice, it was right after that the guardian angel visited me and told me that they were tired and I had to do this on my own. And I had already been introduced to AA. And I think that that was when I really realized that what was happening really was that I was going to die. And I absolutely knew it. And to this day, I know that that's true, that I would have died within the next year or so had I not gotten sober. So I was playing, I finally understood that I was actually playing with my life and came into the program. After they kicked me out of foster, I was there for 2 weeks, I was much more determined than I realized at the time. Because I ended up, I was terrified of leaving foster. I knew that I needed a rehab. I knew that I needed to be taken. I knew that I needed time. I needed to put a few days together. I needed to go to lots of meetings. I understood that. So I immediately ran to Phoenix. And Phoenix was a day program. And I must have been really determined when I look back now, because it was 5 weeks, it was in the winter, and I would go every morning and wait at the bus to get to Phoenix and spend the day there. And, I mean, I wasn't paid for it, and I'd come back home, and it was 5 days a week, and I never missed it, and I graduated from Phoenix. So I was thrilled that I mean, when I realized how much I wanted the program, I started to do 90 meetings in 90 days. I got a sponsor. I read everything I could on self-help. I followed, I did the steps. I did everything that was suggested, except that I got a boyfriend early on, which was fine, actually, when I look back now. But at the time, it was a big taboo, and there were a lot of taboos. But I really believe that it really doesn't matter what else you do, so long as you go to 90 meetings in 90 days, and so long as you go to meetings and deal with, you know, I mean, I think that I have a different perspective on it today. I think that possibly that relationship kept me in the program. Possibly the fact that, you know, that I was going to see this guy at a meeting got me to the meeting at times. So I really don't think that there's any, I really don't have a problem with anything people do as long as they get to meetings. That's it. And I know that a lot of things are dangerous, but there's nothing more dangerous than not going to a meeting in your first year. So I got to meetings, and within 8.5 months, though, because of the same relationship as a result of it, I had a slip. The relationship ended, and I absolutely fell apart for one day, and then I was back. And I was back, and it was very hard. At that point, the first 8.5 months was a gift, and the second was a trudge. But it was a great trudge. It was a wonderfully difficult, horrific AA trudge. I went to meetings again constantly. I began to realize where I really was. After that slip, I understood that I wasn't on step 4 or step 7 or wherever I thought I was, but I was really on step 1. And I was step 1, I did 1 and 2, and where I was at that exact moment in time when I came back and I had to go back to work and decide what it is that I wanted to do with my life, I was on step 3. And I remember going to work at this restaurant that was at the end of a bus stop. I had to walk about 10 blocks, and it was the coldest winter in 40 years, I remember hearing, and I would say the third step prayer out loud. And my sponsor said, you have to say the third step prayer for 3 months. So I did. I said it out loud, walking to my job, and I ended up almost singing that prayer, just shouting that prayer out loud, especially when I said, relieve me of the bondage of self. I loved that line, and I understood by saying it out loud that I was always what got in my own way. And I had decided that I wanted to go back to school because I realized that if I don't give myself something to lose when the shit hits the fan, that I would be in deep trouble. If all I have is a series of failures, you know, in sobriety, and I've gained nothing out of my sobriety, then the alcohol may look really good. Bottle of wine may look great. So I had always wanted to go back to school. So I went back to school. I ran into somebody in the program. There was a whole bunch of women all my age that I made friends with when I came in. And one of them had come in a year after me, and she was already graduating. And I remember seeing her at the bottom of an elevator, and I said, well, I'm going part-time. And she said, she's graduating. And I said, wow. I said, well, it'll take me 3 years. And she said, how old will you be in 3 years if you don't go back? And so I went. I went back, and it really meant a lot to me. And sure enough, I had another slip at a certain point. I was living with somebody who was doing dope at the time, and I thought that I could handle it. And I did. I handled it up until I left. And then 3 days after I left, I had a slip. Because I always thought that what I had to do is to, if I were truly sober, that I could adapt to whatever environment I was in. I could live in any environment because I carried my sobriety with me, so long as I wasn't going to meetings either, but that I somehow overlooked. But I came to realize later on that if I'm really sober, then I'm going to create an environment that is also really sober around me. If I'm really sober, I will not tolerate environments that are really unhealthy for me. But at the time, I thought that I could tolerate really unhealthy environments, and I was fine. I didn't feel like I was testing myself, but I thought that I'd be fine. And I was until I was safe. And the minute I was safe, I fell apart. And I was still in school at the time. And that slip was a dangerous slip for me. I was 5 years sober when I had the slip, almost 5 years sober. And I began to hear myself say things like, well, you know, I can understand why people commit suicide. And I thought, what? And I really had never been suicidal. I began to understand how people threw themselves in front of metros, and I thought, wow, I was spiritually bankrupt. For the first time that, I mean, I really felt completely, I felt worse than I had before I had come in. I wasn't as volatile, I didn't feel things were as dangerous. From the moment that I picked up that drink, I never enjoyed it. I had not one moment of pleasure. I didn't have 5 minutes where I forgot who I was or where I was, and yet I was still drinking. It was unbelievably torturous that entire year, but I didn't know how to stop it. I wasn't willing to go to a meeting. I was terrified. Pride was involved. Finally, I did go back, and it's been 10 years since that day, and I'm absolutely thrilled that I don't have to live that way. Today my life is fairly boring, but I really like it. I have not felt depressed for years. I remember I woke up early in sobriety and experienced an absence of depression. I had never known what it was like not to be depressed, because I was depressed my entire childhood. I didn't realize it. But at some point, quite a while ago, I woke up and realized that I'm actually not depressed. And it's never really returned. It returned that year that I was drinking. That happened before. It returned the year that I was, you know, that I had my slip. But today, I just feel as if I am so fortunate. I feel extraordinarily grateful. And I feel grateful almost all the time. I walk around just thinking, I don't know, you know, how I got so lucky. Sometimes it's kind of scary. I think, wow, I'm bound to experience some bad luck because things are just going so well and have been for so long that, you know, maybe I'll experience maybe something bad will drop out of the sky. And those are old feelings. I really know beyond a shadow of a doubt that there was absolutely nothing else that could have worked for me but AA. I had gone to shrinks. I had gone to shrinks, you know, prior to AA. I've gone to therapists while I was in AA. And I have to say, you know, I mean, some of the therapists were wonderful and are wonderful. But, you know, there'd always be a point in time where I'd be looking at the therapist and I'd think, you know, I could be talking to an AA member with absolutely no experience in anything, and they would know exactly who I was and what was happening and what to do about it if they were just sober and following the steps, you know, in a way that no therapist could ever come close to. It's just amazing to me, you know, what this program has. I really don't understand how the steps were written. I mean, I think they're absolutely ingenious. There's nothing I could ever do to improve on this program. I'm in a good period now. I'm going to meetings, and I tend to stay away from. I tend to, you know, come and go. And whenever I stop going to meetings, I become extremely disconnected. I'm discontent, and I like myself a lot less. So now I'm going to meetings, and I'm happier for it. And I have a hard head. I mean, I have to learn that lesson over and over and over again. And so for today, I've learned that lesson, and I guess that's about all I have to say for now. So thank you.